I guess it's a little bit early, but I know that the, John's presentation is going to be really juicy and somewhat long. So we'd better have him talking than waiting. It is really a pleasure to introduce to you John Donahue. He's very well known to many of you. To some people at NIH, some of old-timers, John has been working here at NIH between 1980 and 84 with Steve Weiss and Ed Edwards in that fantastic neurophysiology lab that Ed Edwards had and that originated really fantastic thinkers, John included, really. His work after that has been really seminal in different areas, initially in the area of brain plasticity and cortical reorganization, particularly in motor cortex. And his work has inspired many, including many investigators at NIH, and include, for example, Mark and myself. Some of his findings have been really tremendously influential. Perhaps what that was my BlackBerry. Perhaps one of the issues that I would like to underline is that John, at a relatively early time, succeeded in bridging what seemed like a tremendously difficult gap, which is the gap from doing studies at the, in doing slice work and animal work in the bench to try to make and actually made an enormous effort to try to utilize that information in obtaining the basic science work to apply it to clinical disease, to human diseases. And what characterizes him is that as everything else he has done this very successfully and in a way that appeals nowadays to a very, very wide group of people as represented in this audience. He is at present professor of neuroscience and engineering at Brown University. He's director of the Brain Science Center, which is a 100 persons investigators group. Which focuses in different areas of interest. It's an interdisciplinary program that's been developing recently there at Brown, and he's also founding chair of the Department of Neuroscience at Brown University. It is really a pleasure, John, that you are here, and I would like to Mark, who's originally motivated this invitation, wanted me to really convey his regrets for not being here as well. So please, let us know about.
Thank you, Leo. Excuse me. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'll point out two kind of conflicts of interest. One is the commercial conflict of interest. I'm going to talk about BrainGate. I'm part of the company that founded the technology, and I'll talk all about how we translated our work into a human clinical trial. So I just want to state that up front. The other one is that actually we're all connected in some way, and that I do have an unabashed conflict of interest in that we have a Brown NIH graduate program in neuroscience called the NPP, and so all of you should know, be aware of that graduate program, and it's a source of graduate students who do their basic science coursework at Brown, but then can come here to the NIH. So, as I said, that's something that I'd be glad to help or facilitate interactions if anybody's interested in that. So, my laboratory is interested in how the cerebral cortex is involved in changing intentions to actions, the processes that occur across cortical areas. And we have a basic science component that studies fundamental things like how there's a monkey catching a cube there and how what processes are going on in its brain as it tries to target that action. But what I want to talk about today is a substantial translational effort. Thanks. Translational effort to take the findings, the knowledge that we and others have gained about how the motor cortex functions, and be able to use that information to help people who are disabled, who are unable to move, who have paralysis and to help restore movement and communication to them. And that's really what I'm going to focus on for this presentation. So you may ask, why would you want this thing, which we call a neural interface system, a connection between the brain and the outside world? Well, there are actually a large number of disorders that result in people who have an intact cerebrum. They can produce the idea, the intentions to move, but they can't actually execute them because the output system is gone. Either there's a transection, a transection of their spinal cord, so they can't get commands to the spinal cord. They've had a stroke. They have degenerative disease like ALS or a whole range of other disorders that I've listed here, even including, for example, limb loss in which the actual effector is no longer present. So the idea is to be able to fix this, to repair this, using our knowledge and being able to use physical components. And so this is a kind of long-term vision of what we might be able to achieve someday, basically a physical nervous system in which a neural interface is able to deliver information, motor intentions, from the brain and out to the body. And, for example, it could attach or drive stimulators in the muscles to actually allow one to reanimate the muscles or allow one to control the muscles again using functional electrical stimulation systems to restore function. Another possibility is to drive assistive technologies, especially for people for whom there may not be a possibility of driving their own muscles. So there are technologies, certainly computers, but there are a variety of elaborate robots that can carry out functions. You saw it opening a bottle, can catch a ball, can do other functions. And these are assistive technologies are also coming along and could be driven neurally, potentially. And then to replace lost function, here's an example of a new arm, a prosthetic arm from DECA, which allows really very impressive control carrying out things. This is a man who's lost both arms in an accident, and he's using this DECA arm to take a drink. He's currently using switches in his shoes, but now imagine someday this is under neural control. So that's sort of the future. The question is, where are we today? So what you're seeing here is a young man in his 20s playing a video game. It's a crude version of something called He-Man, in which you go after the treasure chests with the cursor and you avoid the goblins. And he's doing a fair job. He's going after moving the cursor around. The only thing is that Matthew here is tetraplegic. He was stabbed in the neck at C3, so he's had a full transection of his spinal cord. And the way that he's controlling that cursor is that we have a sensor in the arm area of his motor cortex. It's picking up something related to his intentions to move his arm. And that's being taken to the outside where it's processed, decoded into a signal that's fed into a computer that's now used to drive the mouse. So we call that a neural interface system. It has other names. It's called a brain-computer interface or a BCI. We don't like that term as much because it limits the control just to the idea to computers. They are also called neuromotor prosthesis or brain-machine interface. And what I want to do now is to take you sort of backwards. First, in the first part of my talk about the basic science work that we've done and how we actually got to the point of having a human clinical trial where we could, in fact, test the concept that you could, in fact, use neural signals directly from the brain to control things. And then secondly, I'll go over the clinical trial that we actually did and sort of bring you up to date as to where we are in this pilot clinical trial. And when I say we, excuse me again. When I say we, what I mean is a really not just me, but a very large interdisciplinary team, most of whom are collaborators at Brown, including Michael Black in computer science, who is leading a lot of the decoding efforts that I'll talk about, Arto Nirmico in engineering and physics, who's developing electronics and implantable devices, clinicians Lee Hochberg, who's a clinical PI, neurosurgeon Gerhard Fries, and the folks in my lab that are actively engaged in this project. In addition, I should acknowledge that there's lots of support from many federal agencies, and I'm particularly indebted to the original funding I got from NINDS, which started off my career in 84, and I've been funded since that time. And that's actually been essential, really critical funding to getting the fundamental work done that has led to these clinical studies. So the way we originally thought, thought about this whole problem, it wasn't quite so clear, I think, clearly laid out as it is here when we first thought about how could we connect the brain to the outside world. We said, what are the key steps? Well, one is you have to have some kind of neural sensor, something to pick up brain signals. And then you need to take those signals and decode them or translate them into something that you can make sense of that's actually a command signal that could run some kind of application like a robotic arm or even the person's own muscles. And there are certain fundamental questions associated with this. For example, what area of the brain would you get these signals from? What would the signal be? What are you looking for? What sensor would you use? What sensor is available to get that? Decoding, what would you actually use to decode this information if you could do it at all? And then finally, once you have a command signal, what kinds of things would you hook it up to? So these are essential design issues, and I'll just sort of go through the kinds of things we did leading up to our studies. So I don't think I'm as old as Leonardo da Vinci, but this is sort of an idea of the first ideas of how we controlled our limbs. Da Vinci thought they were fluids pumped from the ventricles. Sort of more modern view, seen here in a monkey brain, is that there are actually multiple cerebral cortical areas that are involved or engaged in controlling arm movements, certainly more than a dozen. And we've focused on the arm area of the primary motor cortex, mainly because there's a lot known about this area. There's a huge amount of studies at the single unit level in animals from this area. It is probably the best understood as being an area that is closest to the final output from the cortex to control the muscles, although these areas certainly work as an integrated whole when producing movements. So we've focused on this arm area of the primary motor cortex as the area where we want to get our signals from. Now, what signals do we want? There are, of course, two types of signals that emanate from the brain, field potentials and action potentials. And although everyone says, of course, this is sort of textbook level kinds of things, in fact, I think there's a resurgence now in trying to understand the relationship between these two signals. One, because almost everything we know and we study in the human comes from field potential activity, EEGs, outside the head kind of activities. And almost everything, with certain certainly notable exceptions, a lot of what we know about information processing, and certainly in the primate brain, comes from recording of action potentials or spikes. And these signals, I maintain, are actually quite different, and I don't think we understand them all that well. So the field potentials, as you recall, are like EEG or ECOG when you take them from inside the skull, or LFP when you record them in the cortex. They're slow, sort of DC to several hundred hertz kinds of potentials, although exactly what they are is debatable. But they represent the summed currents of many neurons, and sometimes they actually include action potentials. And the advantage of them, of course, is they're accessible. You can get them outside the head. And turning to that great source of information, Wikipedia, you can see that they say the field potential is electrical potential whose source and composition is often ambiguous, making its interpretation difficult. So I think it sort of does capture some aspects of the EEG. It's a challenging mixture of signals. Action potentials are sort of a microscale signal. They come from single neurons, of course. And the importance is that they're information rich. We believe they are the code that transmits information quickly around the nervous system. The problem being, though, that they're less accessible. So we've selected to focus on action potentials as the source of our signal. And here's just a recording. This actually comes from a human motor cortex, just to point out sort of by observation the kinds of differences you can see in field potentials and action potentials. These are both recorded from the same microelectrode. They're just filtered differently to see slow and fast potentials. And you can see the spiking occurring. You can see the field potentials. And I think all I wanted to point out here is things go on in the field potential that don't seem to be reflected in the spikes and vice versa. So there isn't a straight and easy interpretation of the relationship between these signals. In fact, that's one of the things both Leo's lab and my lab and many others are interested in. What is the relationship between these two? Now, so if we're interested in spikes, our problem or our issue has been, how do we get access to these? We need a device that not only picks up these signals, but is able to pick them up for a long period of time if we're aiming towards a permanently implantable device for humans. And in fact, we don't want just one cell, but we need many because we believe that we get more information from recording from many electrodes. So, the standard tool is an invasive device, the microelectrode, been around for many decades. The problem had been when we were pursuing this early, sort of in the 1990s, was coming up with a reliable technique to record many cells at the same time. And in fact, this electrode array was invented by Dick Norman, and in fact, he and I developed this further as a chronically implantable device for monkeys, and then eventually it was taken by CyberKinetics to become something that is now a human implantable device. So it's 100 microelectrodes in a 4x4 millimeter patch, so it's about the size of a baby aspirin. Each one of these electrodes is basically like a standard microelectrode. It's got a conductor at the tip, and it's coated with plastic. And they're all separate. And they, as you can see here, you can get an impression of the scale of the electrodes. Now, in the current version, the electrodes come back through a wire bundle and through a pedestal connector that's attached to the skull, goes through the skin, and there's a connector that is where everything is connected to the outside to where all the signals are processed on the outside. And although I won't talk about all this, developing all these is actually quite sophisticated technology. Having high-density connectors and things were actually a number of technical challenges. So just to give you a sense of how this goes in, what we basically do, so this is the 2 millimeter thick cortex. There's a hole made in the bone. The array is inserted. It's actually tapped in. The bone is closed. The skin is closed, and this connector comes to the outside. This is the device we set up for monkeys and is also used in the early human trials. And so this just sort of gives you a picture. Here's a window into a monkey brain. For those of you who want to get oriented that know monkey brains, this is the arcuate and the central sulcus. So the array is implanted in the motor cortex. You can see it after implantation. It's rather straightforward. One of the things we know we can do now is we can actually remove it. And here we removed it 4 weeks after implantation. There's certainly some kind of reaction there. But if we look 3 months later after we close, you can see the cortex looks very good. So these can be put in, taken out. And in fact, we reinsert them. We do this in monkeys routinely for different reasons, and they work. And so by work, I mean that you get many signals at the same time. Each one of these little squares here is the signal recorded at one of the electrodes. So you can see each one of these little check marks then is an action potential, so we get many. This is a particularly good one. We don't always get that many. Here's a very good recording of a single one, and sometimes we even get more than one cell on an electrode. So they work. We asked the question early on, how long will they last? Because there's a lot of concern, and I'll address this more with the human studies later on. But we studied three animals. We lasted 514, 154, or 83 days. That's when we gave up and decided to write the paper, not that the electrodes ended at that time. But at that time, we showed that about 60 channels lasted throughout the duration of recordings. You can see it ranged from about 60 to close to 90 across the three animals we studied. So we said over the course of 500 days or more, we could, in fact, record signals that would be useful in such a device. So we sort of said, okay, we have a sense of the area, the signal, the sensor. If we get these signals, can we make sense out of them? Well, fortunately, there's a long history of recording in monkeys and looking at population codes and how to make sense out of what's going on in the cortex. So we have this, what's called the decoding problem, translating the signal into a control signal. And decoding actually has, I think, sort of three parts. Well, one of them is strictly neurophysiology. That is, when people who are decoding are actually trying to figure out what information is available in the neurons. The second part is the computation. That is, when you have these patterns of information coming out from neurons, how do you actually transform that pattern into a command signal? And then another challenge, if you want to make a device that's a real-time device, you have to do that very quickly. You have to get those commands transformed into something useful very fast. So that requires sophisticated processors, which fortunately are now available. So what information is there? Well, we know from many years of studies that there's information about movement timing, force, the trajectory of the hand, including a whole bunch of kinematic information. This was derived from having monkeys perform various behavioral tasks with their arm by looking at some visual cues on a screen. One of the fundamental findings came from Ed Everett's lab was just simply that these cells fire before the onset of movement, suggesting that they, of course, are involved in driving that movement. So here we see just the repeated trials of a monkey moving, and you can see this cell fires prior to the onset of movement. But significantly, and you know, now decades of studies have shown that these other variables are encoded in the firing of motor cortex. And here's just one important variable that came from Georgopoulos's group originally, that if you have a monkey move in various directions, say in a circle, what you find out is that these neurons are tuned to direction. That is, they fire most in one direction and they fire less in others. So therefore, you can extract the direction of hand motion from the firing of neurons. So the way we do this, I won't go into any detail, but it's basically a linear regression problem in which you're trying to map some parameter of motion, like hand velocity, onto the firing rates of cells, and you need to learn a filter. And so we can do that by recording while the animal is moving, and we can learn how the hand is moving, and we can learn how the neurons are firing, and derive that coefficient. So for just a sort of an intuitive sense, for those of you who don't record every day, and I apologize for those of you who have done, you know, are intimately involved with this. This is for the simplistic example. But imagine now you were just trying to build a decoder that was simply left and right, and you observed a neuron that was firing 7 impulses to the left and 1 to the two impulses to the right. Then, in fact, you could decode that activity if it was reliable, that every time you had a count of 7 in an interval, then you would know that there was a motion to the left. Of course, the count is more variable across neurons than that, because other kinds of information is encoded. And so by recording many neurons, we can average basically across many neurons, and we can get a more reliable predictor of what kind of motion is being encoded and what is intended in the spiking of the neurons at that time. So we can test that idea by just actively trying to decode in real time and see if that activity can substitute for actual hand motion. So here's just a kind of a task that we gave a monkey. We called it a pinball task, in which there's a target that appears on the screen at random locations. The monkey's job is simply to move the cursor to that target, and every time he hits the target, he gets a drop of juice. While we did that, we recorded from the motor cortex and built a decoder that mapped the hand's motion to the neural activity of the hand motion to the motion of the hand itself. So if that decoder worked, we should be able to plug the decoder output directly into the computer, and the monkey could go right on playing. And in fact, that's just what happened. So this is Misha Soroya's work. He published in 2002. So the green dot now is under neural control, and the and you can see the monkey is able to move the cursor over, hit this target, and he got rewarded for that action. So this showed immediate closed-loop control. Closed-loop means that the monkey was getting visual feedback of the outcome of the decoding, and it was able to use direct neural activity, bypassing the muscles altogether, and control the cursor. I might mention also that this various versions of this kind of experiment have been replicated by a number of labs. Don Taylor and Andy Schwartz showed that this actually can be accomplished in 3 dimensions just about the same time as Misha's paper. And then there's been a number of other studies showing that, in fact, you can decode sufficiently quickly and accurately to replicate many of these hand functions. So at this point, since we had addressed many of these issues of what sensor, what area, what signal, and actually had a proof of concept that you could actually decode activity, we said, could we push forward this idea, translate this basic science finding into something that could really help individuals who can't otherwise move at all? So this led to the formation of CyberKinetics. The idea was to form a company that could raise the amount of money that would be necessary to take this device and make it into something that would be useful in a human, that could be tested in a human. And just to give you a sense, that took 30 people 1 year and $6 million to go from what we had in the lab to a product that was FDA approved for a pilot clinical trial in 10 patients. In addition, one of the things that particularly excited me was that for the first time, we were able to look at multiple single units in the human brain in individuals who had degenerative diseases or traumatic injury or stroke. And so in addition to be able to help them, we were actually being able to observe units in humans and feed that information back into an academic setting. I can tell you now, based on now about 4 years of experience, this is an extremely difficult challenge. There are lots of barriers to doing it, but I think we're at sort of an important time where these things have to be thought through about how do you get information from the lab, from this kind of preclinical work into actual human applications, which is really what we're all about, I think. So here's the basic human system, and it's fundamentally just like the monkey system, the same electrode array, the same connector and pedestal, the same basic decoding algorithms, and then a signal processor and basically a cart full of electronics on the outside that does the processing, feeds into a computer, and the participant sees their output as a, in this case, as a cursor on the screen that reflects their intention to move their arm. Now, the people that have been enrolled so far in the study, we've had 4 individuals, all of whom are tetraplegic. They can't move their arms and legs. There are 2 with cervical spinal cord injury. You saw Matthew earlier as one, and I'll show you some more examples of him in a bit. 1 with a brainstem stroke, and I'll show you what her stroke looked like. But she was tetraplegic, not speaking, but actually she had sensation relatively intact. And 1 patient with ALS, 6 years out, who was not only tetraplegic but unable to speak as well. So just, I think all of you are familiar with ALS, degenerative disease of the motor neurons, and also some degeneration in the cortex. Spinal cord injury, I think you're familiar with. Brainstem stroke, you may not be familiar with, but this is our participant's brain, and you can see there's a big piece of the pons missing here. That's exactly where the path from the motor cortex down through the pons and into the cortical spinal tract is found, so it's been removed. You can see it at higher magnification here, so this is a rather significant injury. She was initially, in 1997, completely locked in, unable to move anything but her eyes. Now she can actually, she can make sounds but can't speak, and she can move her eyes and neck and head. So in this trial, what we were trying to do, of course, the first and most important thing is patient safety. Can these devices be put into the brain and be there without adverse events, infections, or other kinds of damage? So far we have 2,200 patient days with no significant adverse device events, which means that nothing basically has gone wrong. There's no concerns about having this tiny implant in the brain. Sort of scientifically and for development of neural interfaces, of course, the important things to us would be, is there any neural activity left in the motor cortex years after an injury? Does it shut down? Does it reorganize? These are fundamental questions that were unknown, and we'd be interested in what happens at the unit level to the motor cortex after longstanding injury. Secondly, if there is activity, can you merely think about moving or have an intention to move or have some aspect of like that can actually drive the motor cortex? Ordinarily, we think of the primary motor cortex as operating when you actively move, but not necessarily when you're just thinking about moving. So we had to ask that question whether we could still activate the neurons. And then finally, if you could activate them, could you do something useful with them, with these kinds of signals? So we were very fortunate in that we had to, say, where do we want to implant this electrode array? There's substantial evidence in humans that this area around the precentral gyrus, this knob, this bump, is an area that where the arm-related activity is. This came from a paper of Ussery, and we found that in all of our patients. Here's this region in Matthew, our first patient, spinal cord injured patient, and here's the implant in that region in the knob. So all of the patients were implanted in this arm area knob based on only anatomical MR imaging. This just gives a picture. You'll actually get to see a video in a second. So here's a close-up of the array in a human brain. SC3 is actually this stroke patient. You'll see that number a couple of times. Here's the little inserter putting it in, but you'll get a chance to see that. There'll be a little tap, and that's when it's inserted. That was the tap.
Thank you.
So the array is now, it's really quite simple, straightforward procedure for a neurosurgeon. You can see there's a small craniotomy, an opening in the dura, and then the array implanted. The first questions, do we have signals remaining, and do they change with intention to move? So this is an experiment that was actually inspired by a 1970 or 72 set of experiments in Ebb Fetz's lab, in which monkeys were shown a fuel gauge or a dial and asked to learn to modulate their neurons. So We, in fact, set something up in which we were recording from this. In this case, this is our stroke patient, S3. And what she saw on the screen was actually a red dot. And when the red dot turned green, she was supposed to imagine an action. We had actually already figured out that imagining wrist would activate this neuron. And the little dial would go up. And in fact, this little white dot also moves over when you see it. So every time the light turns green, she's supposed to activate the neuron. Here's the neuron we're recording. When all this, there's a mask on here. When I take it away, you'll see a lot more stuff. You'll see the sweep of the spike going by. But just to give you a sense of what you're supposed to look at. So the point is, there are cells there, and do they modulate? So you can see she can readily turn that on. Here's this neuron. This is just a recording again. You'll get a chance to see her.
I'm not trying to keep it there for 30 seconds, okay?
So one of the things is she can just voluntarily hold the neuron at a high level by thinking about action. So this is, you know,
let's try to do that again.
So immediately we saw in all the patients that not only were their neurons there, but they were able to activate them by thinking about hand actions, which was actually kind of surprising considering this woman hadn't used her hands or any part of her arm in 9 years at the time of this recording. In addition, we saw activation in the ALS patients, so I won't go through all what's here. Just the point is there are lots of neuron activity in ALS. This was, of course, unknown because in ALS there is degeneration in the motor cortex. It's highly variable how much there is. So in this one patient so far that we've studied with ALS, we have seen that there's plenty of neural activity, and you'll see that he's able to control it in a couple of minutes. So what are the properties like of these neurons? Well, there are many different kinds of activations for different body parts. If we ask the patient to imagine moving up, down, or the right, up, left, and down, you can see that there's a neuron that fires differently, so it is directionally tuned. It actually has different firing properties with imagined action in different directions. In addition, in amongst these cells, we see cells that fire with other actions, like hand actions, opening and closing. So here are three neurons that fire with hand close and then not with opening. And it doesn't need much analysis to see there's a very nice correlation between the imagined closing and opening of the hand and the firing rate of the cells. In addition, so we can see here's an example of a cell that's tuned to ulnar deviation of the wrist and doesn't fire as much with radial deviation of the wrist. We actually tested the passive receptive field in the cell, and you can see that this, when you bend the wrist, you can see activation. So this cell fires similarly with an imagined action and also with sensory input. This is in our S3 patient that has intact sensory input. And here's an example of a cell that doesn't fire much or is maybe suppressed a little bit with an imagined actions of the wrist, but has a nice sensory input shown here in green when the wrist is manipulated. So we see remaining sensory inputs. We see mixtures of things in which we have sensory and motor related activation, if it's motor when you imagine and it's activated. And we see cells that have other properties. In addition, I'll just show you, this is just to show you that there are cells that are active, single cells activated by multiple parts of the body. So each one of these are rasters as we ask the individual to make various kinds of movements. All the green ones here are various kinds of wrist. This box is elbow, and all these are shoulder. And what you can see is this cell was activated with imagined wrist actions, imagined elbow actions, and imagined shoulder actions. Some and not others. So, in fact, there was a very rich and complex set of properties that simply imagining action got these cells to become activated. So then we actually were faced by a somewhat challenging question. How do you build a filter in these individuals? Remember, in the monkeys, we had ground truth. We knew what the monkey's arm was doing when we were trying to map neural activity from the motor cortex to the arm. So I'm not going to go into great detail as to how we do this, except to tell you that basically what we do is we show the patient the computer moving the cursor, and we tell them, you imagine that you're doing it. And then we take the coefficients from that activity and produce a filter. It produces a very poor filter. It doesn't work very well. So then what we do is we show people the outcome of that filter, and they have very poor control, and we repeat that about four times. And after about four times, we can get reasonably good control that parallels that of the monkey, and I'll show you some of that. So when we go from what's called open-loop control, in which there's no neural feedback, and they're just thinking about moving something that they're actually not controlling, back to something that they are actually controlling themselves with visual feedback, so we call that closed-loop control. So here I'll just show you an example of an early session with Matthew. Many of you have seen this movie before, but it's always informative. And I put a quote from Matthew as to what he thought he was doing, and the patients don't have any real deep insight as to how it's working. They just make it work. So I'll just let Matthew narrate this. You'll see him using a linear filter decoder, just like we used in the monkeys, and he's going to be trying to open an email program. It's just a program we made up with an envelope that he has to select, and then a message comes up. And then I'll show you three attempts to draw a circle with a little paint program with a paint inkwell and an eraser, and you can see how he performs. So this was very early on in the study, and he narrates it. He and a technician. So, and you can also appreciate, here's the pedestal connector with an amplifier on it.
Okay, so here's the CyberKinetics desktop. What are you going to do first?
Gonna open my email first.
Okay.
This is the email.
Gonna open the first one.
You're gonna open the first one.
And it says, congratulations, you are doing a great job.
Very good.
Open the second email.
Okay.
This one says, hi, we'll talk soon.
Great. Now can you exit back to the CyberKinetics desktop?
I'm going to exit.
You're going to exit. Excellent. So what's next?
Next, I'd like to draw a circle.
You're going to draw a circle? Wow.
So I'm going over to paint.
So first attempt was not a circle.
Let's try it again.
Here we go.
Oops. You avoided the eraser that time.
When I see this, I think of a little kid first using a crayon.
Okay.
This was about 10 minutes later, I think. I can't, but this is his third attempt.
Excellent.
So he was actually able to get a loop and showed some kind of improvement in control. How to interpret that, I don't know. So the question is, how quickly can you learn? And let me start this from the beginning here because it's important. So the question is, how quickly can you learn to do this? So I want to show you a video of our ALS patient. This is the first moment after we built the filter of him trying to control. It's a grid task, and this is the first time he's used the cursor, and we're asking him to control the cursor to identify, to move the cursor to grids. And you'll see the technician explaining the task to him. And I have to skip over this here.
Basically see a grid of squares, they're all blue. There are 16 of them on screen.
Patient's
here. Hand, which is controlled by your thought. And basically the goal is to move the hand to acquire the orange square as soon as it turns orange.
So you can see that literally, as soon as you turn it on, he was able to just do the task before he even got the instructions. So there's really, you know, it can be picked up, and as soon as we have a decoding filter, the idea of controlling it is just immediate. Now, to get a better handle on how well can you control this, we started testing patients, all the patients, on a center out task. Basically, there's one of four targets would appear, and the patient would have to move the cursor out to the target to get a reward. In this case, we use money bags because Matthew liked to gamble. So instead of juice reward that's used for monkeys, we used money bags to motivate him. So in this task, he was able to reach the targets. And I'll just show you videos. It's kind of busy, but it just shows all four patients doing the center out task. And what's obvious from all of them is, first, they can all do it, which was surprising in that we have two spinal cord injured patients that were about 3 years out. We have a locked-in stroke patient that has intact sensation but is paralyzed, and an ALS patient. The second thing you can notice is they're all equally wobbly. The cursor is wobbly. It's not stable as a regular mouse cursor, and they have a hard time. In fact, it's very basically impossible for them to stop it in a location. All they can do is sweep through targets. But with that, so here's Matthew's data. He was achieving between something like 70 and 90% success on successive sessions. And his trial speed, this is how quickly he was able to reach the target. You can see that he had a much broader distribution than able-bodied subjects, shown here in red, of moving the cursor from point to point. So he's much slower and much more variable, but nevertheless he accomplished it. So thanks to input from Michael Black, we've actually been working on how do you improve cursor control. And we've been developing something called a Kalman filter with a state decoder. The Kalman filter basically takes into account the spike statistics. It is a probabilistic algorithm that says what is the likelihood of this outcome given the input. So, for example, if you get a very wobbly cursor, that's not a likely outcome from the neural data. Therefore, it weights it very lowly, so that at a very low level. So that results in much more stable cursor performance. In addition, we had the patient imagine squeezing her hand or squeezing a mouse button to stop the cursor and click. And so what she's achieving here is she's moving out to a target, and she's going to it, and she can stop and click on any target. So now we've achieved pretty much mouse-like function, being able to go to a target, stop, and click on it with very high accuracy, although, again, slower than normal. So here's showing you the cursor paths, the wobbly cursor path of three sessions, using the linear filter, and here now you can see this Kalman filter in three sessions. You can see you get much better paths in control, with certainly some variability. As I said, I just want to show that we are actually able to not only decode the direction, but also the state the neurons, or basically a click signal that is a state. So when the person imagines clicking, there's a change in activity. I think you can see it here. Here's a neuron where during this imagined click period, there's an elevation in activity. Here's another one here. And here's one where there's a drop in activity. And these click activities can be in neurons that have directional tuning or neurons that don't have directional tuning. They can be combined in every possible combination. So we can exploit that, and we use that state decoding as a way to estimate when she wants to click. What you can see is there's all kinds of performance, and I've mentioned several times that there's variability in performance. And right now in the field, it's actually not clear how you can, in fact, estimate how well people are doing. Everybody has their own measures. So we're actually trying to introduce something that's an ISO 9000 industry standard for mouse control. And it has a whole set of parameters that you can use to then evaluate the control, and then we can compare from day to day between patients and also between investigators or between laboratories. The only thing I want to point out here is this is a false click rate of our patients, one patient across multiple days, and you can see that the false click rate, the error ability to click on what you want is quite high, and these error measures are very good in that there's low error, but so accuracy is good, but again, overall control is slower than normal. For the sake of time, I'll just mention that we are looking at local field potentials, but we haven't incorporated them into control except in very minimal ways. And so this is just a figure to point out that there is information you can see in this spectrogram that when the patient is told to go to a target, there's a suppression of a beta oscillation in the signal. And so that suppression is actually seen when there's actual movement. So we can potentially use this information, and I won't go into it, and other directional information to add to the reliability of control using field potentials. So with this signal, we've actually done a bunch of demonstrations to show how well can you possibly control devices. So these are demos set up just to see what was possible to do with this with this neural control signal. So I'm going to show you an example of using typing with a computer interface, control of a prosthetic hand, and reaching and grasping with a robotic arm. So this is our brainstem stroke patient using an interface that's basically she's doing one finger typing. She points to a key, clicks on it, and then types the letter on this computer interface, and then guesses what word, just like smartphones do. She's trying to type, and she can select that word if that's the correct choice. So this is the first time she's had sort of a speech interface. So I think I asked her what she thought of the technology. And so she can just activate the speaker. And she can select the word like that, and she can actually say the phrases through this speech interface. And this is just an example of controlling a TV interface through the same very flexible computer interface. So they can achieve sort of everyday functions. In addition, we asked, what happens when you try to control a real device? This is basically a one-dimensional prosthetic hand that's motor-driven, and we asked Matthew to control it. So here is his, you can hear his reaction to being able to control this. This was really the first time he tried to do it, if I can get this to him.
Close, holy shit.
I think that encapsulates the sort of view.
Nice, open, close.
So he could look at this hand and open and close it. He did use it quite frequently, and he was able to pinch with it. To control it accurately, have to sort of pinch somebody with it and play around with it a little bit. So this was really something that, just demonstrating you control something physical. Here's a more complex object. This is Matthew. It's sorry for the grainy movie, but it's a simple interface to control this robotic arm that has a gripper and multi-joint control. And he was supposed to give this piece of candy to the technician over here. So he's moving this. This is literally the first time he ever saw this. So we just told him about this interface, and he was able to, you know, grip the piece of candy and hand it to somebody. So again, he can quickly use these control signals to perform functions. They're not available every day now. There are, of course, concerns about reliability and stability, which is essential to these things. We've encountered concerns in every aspect of this. There's physical, or what we call biostability concerns. Biostability means the body attacks the device. In Matthew, we saw some leakage in the array. There's physical, that is motion, that is things the electrode array could move, and biological, of course, the body's reaction to the presence of a foreign body. I'll show you that we've actually encountered the first two. I've been impressed that there's not that much of a response of the tissue to the electrode, or at least nothing we can account. Nothing in it that we can say that has been the cause of the loss of signal. But let's start with the ALS patient. You can see that he had about 90 units all the way through. There were some ups and downs that I'll talk about in a second. And over here on day 288, he had still more than 80 neurons he was recording. Unfortunately, he suffered a ventilation disconnect, and he passed away because it wasn't detected in time to reintubate him. So that was the end of our recordings. In this case, you can see there's a clear drop-off. There was an abrupt change, and we had a large number of cells, abrupt change. It came back up, and there were a number of abrupt changes. And actually, we're now out here at 820 days, I think it is, and there's about 40 neurons. These drops in these two patients made us very suspicious as to what was going on. We went back and found out that, in fact, the surgeon had tied a knot on the array to the dura. There's about 1.5 millimeters of shear force, as best we can estimate, between the dura and the array. The fact that they stayed in at all was now surprising to us. In fact, on this day, we know there was a correlated event. Our patient was dropped on her bed at that day. And so we don't know that this is the cause, but we're suspicious that these kind of bumpy trajectories are due to this tethering problem. But the real essence of how well you can record is how well you can use the device to do things. So this is at 800 days. This is patient 3. And we're now using a sort of a graphical interface to test what happens when she sees a version of a hand moving. And so she's getting 100% success of point and click. The jumps are actually graphical issues. It's not in the smoothness of neural control. It's a graphic rendering issue between the movies. But she can go out to any target on the screen and point and click. And so we're at 2.2 now, actually a little more than 2.25 years. So we're still recording. So these implants, neural interfaces, can last for several years at least. If they do fail, we know they can be removed easily and based on our monkey work replaced. So this is just Matthew's array when it was originally placed. And here it was 14 months later when it was removed. The cortex looks fine. You can see it after it was explanted. Little dimples here where it was placed, but otherwise the brain looks in very good shape. So where we are now is we have the motor signals that are in the motor cortex that we would have anticipated from monkeys, able-bodied monkeys, are still there years after stroke or spinal cord injury or ALS, that simply thinking about action is able to activate these neurons. And we see a very wide set of responses active with all kinds of imagined actions. We can produce useful control signals from these. In paralyzed humans, they can be used for activities that could be very useful in their daily lives to restore independence and communication. And we've demonstrated that through a variety of devices. And I think the other significant thing here is that we've provided a new window on human brain function that hasn't been available in the past, which I think will lead to many years of exciting and new insights into stroke progression, degenerative disease progression like ALS, and the consequences of spinal cord injury on the brain. But I want to emphasize, you know, the control is clearly not as fast or complex or reliable as it is in an able-bodied human. It's a pilot technology. We have cables and things that have to be removed. And there are these technical challenges that I just addressed. So where we are today is we have percutaneous connector, technician running the whole thing, tethering, we have this cart, and we want to move to a wireless, fully automated, implanted and portable device. And we are, in fact, developing, thanks to a BRP grant, a bioengineering research partnership grant from the NIH, developing a fully implantable wireless system. So here's just schematically the array in the brain, which has an active amplifier on the back of the array, a cable going to a module under the skin that then transmits the information out. And here's a prototype of that device that's now being tested this year in monkeys. So here's the array, here's a cable, and here's the module that's implanted under the skin and on top of the skull that transmits the information to the outside. And this is a partnership between Brown and CyberKinetics and the folks at Case Western. In addition, if in fact you could then have a reliable, fully implantable device, you could connect that up to something like an FES system, a functional electrical stimulation system, which is a device that already exists, that's an implantable system that can be activated to stimulate muscles. So in an FES system, for those of you who don't know, you have an implanted stimulator, and there's some kind of switching device, typically on the outside. And when you activate that switch, the stimulating electrodes contract the muscles that are connected to the stimulator. And people who have certain kinds of spinal cord injury can recover grasp and be able to pick things up and bring them to their mouths. So we're working, in fact, we have a collaborative effort with the group at Case Western's FES Center to then connect BrainGate up to this system and allow people, again, to reanimate their muscles, to be able to, again, just like you and I do, think and move their arm muscles. Of course, the first actions will be very crude and very primitive, but we're hoping that eventually it will get better and better. In order to develop this, this is a virtual reality system in which we're putting muscle-like properties into the arm so that people with BrainGate implants now can practice using output systems that behave like a limb without actually having an FES system.
Weight is another big challenge.
I think you've seen that. I'll skip to the last slide. Excuse me, here. That sort of looks at what's the future of all of this technology. So I think I've pointed out that there's great promise from the pilot work that we've done, this translational study into humans, that in fact we will be able to provide a sensor in the brain that will give independence, communication, and control to individuals that have paralysis. We'll be able to give them access to assistive technologies, switches and controls on the outside world, robotic limbs potentially, or to FES systems that allow them to control their own limbs again. In addition, this kind of brain sensor could provide us a whole new range of neural outputs that could be used in a number of other ways. For example, one application that we're beginning to test is, could you use this as a sensitive measure of an impending seizure? So this is work that's being done both at Columbia and at Mass General with arrays implanted in conjunction with subdural grid implants in persons who are going to have surgery to have tissue removed related to relieve epilepsy. And so in conjunction with that subdural implant for about 2 weeks, we also put in an array, and during that time we monitor activity. So far what we're doing is simply looking at the relationship between spiking activity and the emergence of a seizure, and there are some hints at things, but nothing definitive yet. But you could imagine someday an implant that would in fact allow people to know that a seizure was going to come, allow them to get into a safe environment, take medication, or better yet, be part of a closed-loop system that would actually shut down the seizure itself or deliver medication locally. So this is a futuristic kind of thing, but the groundwork is now being laid, and it's possible with this kind of technology. And you might think of applying these same kinds of approaches to other disorders like psychiatric disease or brain injury or to pain. So there's really a huge, I think, future for these kind of neural interfaces that will provide a physical interaction with the nervous system and provide us readout and actually read in through stimulation to the nervous system to allow a whole new way of treating neurological disease with physical devices rather than only biological or pharmacological solutions. So with that, I'll just say thank you, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Are those units correlated or the same units that end up being the most useful for your filter? I guess what I'm getting at is, are these patients really attempting to move their hand to control a mouse, or are they learning to control the cursor separate from
It's a great question. So I can't answer. We don't have the right kind of analysis to answer that. You know, we use every neuron that we can find, and if they modulate with imagined actions, then they are a great source of information for the filter. So typically, my general opinion, without having a careful analysis, is that those are key to the actual imagined actions. Now, the question you asked, and I skipped over it quickly, is, you know, what do the patient, because you can ask the patient, what are you doing? And they sort of make up an answer. It would be just like asking a child, what happens in your brain when you pick up your toothbrush in the morning? And they'll come up with a story, you know, I think about moving my hand out, and I think about closing and opening my hand and bringing, but of course that's not in any way related to what really is going on. They don't really have any fundamental insight into that. So I think they will make up various solutions to what's actually going on. So in humans, we have, because of the way the trial is set up, of course, we only put the array in the place, this knob area of the arm area of motor cortex. In monkeys, that there's extensive data that in all of those areas that I showed you, the multiple regions that have arm-related information, you can, of course, get information about various kinds of arm motion. And there have been, in my lab and other labs, you can get information from premotor cortex, from parietal cortex, from potentially other areas. That hasn't... Well, Krishna Shenoy's lab has shown, for example, that you can use premotor cortex to get very reliable signals in monkeys for as a control signal. I don't know. That's certainly an interesting question about whether you can learn these areas where that are sort of in a loose sense uncommitted to a particular task, whether you can learn. I think Andy was...
There's got to be a stability issue of decoding that is, you know, after 2 hours. true intentionally driven system, target oriented for specific movement.
Yeah, so the answer is, the answer to the second one is we are looking at that, what is the signal actually related to? But I think that the stability question is a much more immediate question that we're looking at, because we don't know all the sources of variance, but there are multiple sources of variance. So far, we've tracked down sort of technical ones. For example, the connector that I pointed out is very elaborate. And little changes, for example, a change in the quality of the signal can change what unit gets into the decoder, which can influence. We've actually caught that two or three times now, contributing to poor control. There's almost certainly underlying biological instabilities. And in Matthew's case, to a first approximation, I would say during the course of a day, it looks very stable. That's not always true, and it also depends on the filter. So we do build a new filter each day because we have an inherent belief that what's there the next day is somewhat different in their properties. That needs to be very carefully investigated about how much instability there is. Then you have two adaptive systems to correct for that. The first adaptive system is the human. We don't know how well humans can just overcome instabilities, I think getting to sort of what your second question was. And the second is, of course, we need a hierarchy of adaptive computer algorithms that will be checking to see that there's been some instability and that it can correct for it, which I actually think can be done in a straightforward way once we understand some more of these sources of variance. I'll give you one example for the people who are interested in just how the cortex works. We have seen several examples of cells where a channel has nothing on it, and then 30 minutes into the session, it's just there. And this is not a motion of electrode, because we have, 99 or really 96 other electrodes that are sitting there that haven't changed at all. So they're very sensitive to any motion. All of a sudden, this neuron is on. We don't know why it came on or what has influenced it. So those kinds of non-stationarities are also going to contribute and need to be studied.
Do you think we can get speech impaired patients right?
So Phil Kennedy is attempting to do this with a different kind of recording technology that I think has more limited signals. So it's only a guess. I mean, if you were in Broca's area and you have an output that's a motor-like output, that you would get something related to the variables that are controlled in speech. Therefore, you should be able to decode it with the right signal, but that's just a speculation.
But I was thinking with the individual would make it circuit.
Oh, have them sign their name or something. Well, the stability, I think, right now is not good enough to do that. But that's sort of another demonstration that would be interesting to try. He made it an O of a certain type. One of the critical things to remember here is that even when a child draws the letter O with a crayon, they're using millions of neurons in all parts of the nervous system. Here we have, a ridiculously impoverished sample of dozens of neurons, and we're asking it to perform the same way with our best guess of how a computer can make up for the huge losses of information. What's impressive to me, anyway, is how well it did.
Do you have a sense of how often or how long you can record the same spikes from one day to the next?
No, because I'm not convinced there's a way to know that. But if you have a good set of criteria that would convince anyone, that you have the same cell every day, that would be something to discuss. But that's a very thorny issue. Basically, we think, we have some cells for a long time, and we have other cells that switch. But we don't really know.
One more question.
Yeah, well, there's clearly additional information from taking the covariances in the population. We can add information, but it's not a huge amount, but it's something that there is more information available. And in effect, what we do does capture some of that.
I think that we should probably stop here. Thank you very much, John.